President Bill Clinton was on the University of Kansas campus this week as he received the 2015 Dole Leadership Prize. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, we'll hear his acceptance speech in which he calls for bipartisanship and talks about his relationship with Senator Bob Dole. Clinton spoke to a sold-out crowd at the Lead Center on Monday, November 23rd. It's a return visit for the 42nd president, who spoke at KU's Allen Fieldhouse in May 2004 when he gave the inaugural Dole Lecture. It's also the second presidential visit of the year. President Barack Obama spoke at the University of Kansas on January 22, 2015, becoming the fourth sitting U.S. president to visit KU. According to the Dole Institute of Politics, the Dole Leadership Prize is awarded annually to an individual or group whose public service leadership inspires others. Previous winners include President George H.W. Bush, former President of South Africa Nelson Mandela, and former President of Ukraine Viktor Yushchenko. Organizations that have won the Dole Leadership Prize include the Wounded Warrior Project and WASP, the World War II Women Air Force Service Pilots. The Dole Leadership Prize comes with a cash award of $25,000. In introducing Clinton, Dole Institute Director Bill Lacey made the following announcement.
I am very pleased to announce that our recipient today has chosen to donate that award back to the Dole Institute to seed our new Women in That money will seed our new Women in Leadership Lecture, which we plan to introduce in the next couple years. Our recipient's commitment to bipartisanship can be fully seen in one of the thousands of amazing historical artifacts from the Dole Institute archive. It's a handwritten note on a White House card from 1997 that reads, "Dear Bob, I enjoyed our visit and Sox loved his president from leader. If a dog can reach out to a cat, who knows what wonders of cooperation the next year might hold." Sincerely, Bill. It's my great honor to welcome to the University of Kansas and the Dole Institute the recipient of the 2015 Dole Leadership Prize and the 42nd President of the United States, President Bill Clinton.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bill. Thank you and Barbara for your work at the Dole Institute. Thank you, Christina, and all the Student Advisory Board members. We just had a picture backstage, and they were all organized with a gap in the middle, and I ran and filled the gap, and I told them, you know, when these pictures come out, it's going to like look like you went to a wax museum. We found this old pasty model and gathered around it. I want to thank a number of people who are here with whom I served to work in some capacity or another, including your former governor, John Carlin, who was also the archivist of the United States when I was here as president. Governor Kathleen Sebelius, who was Secretary of Health and Human Services. And a man for whom I will, to the end of my life, have a special debt, former Congressman Jim Slattery. Thank you for being here. The last thing Jim said to me as he walked away from the line a minute or so ago is, "I'm still number 218, referring to the fact that I passed my economic plan in 1993, designed to reverse the one Bob Dole believed in, by one vote. And it was an expensive vote for a lot of members of Congress, though I believe it led to the longest economic expansion in American history in peacetime, and eventually four budget surpluses in a row for the first time since the 1920s. There are a lot of other people here too many to mention, but Bob Dole called me a couple of days ago, and he said that he was especially grateful, given the fact that I'm here to talk about bipartisanship, for two people in this audience who have been both strong supporters of the Dole Institute and of me and our family, Sue Ellen and Harvey Freed. If you find people that like us both, that's the beginning of bipartisanship. So I thank them. I want to thank my personal assistant without whom I could not function, a graduate of the University of Kansas, Hannah Rickard, who's been with me every day since I left the White House. I want to thank her. She's here today. And every March, she always picks Kansas in the basketball pool in our office. And half of us just go along with her. One of my Secret Service agents here, whose father was one of my detail heads when I was president, who played football here, Rashad Spriggs, is here. I thank him. And I now have a scheduler from Kansas, and her parents are here, Jean Miller. Thank you for the Millers coming. And Rashawn Parrish is here, who advanced this for me. She lives in Kansas City, so I could tell her one more time that Kansas City had the most complete baseball team I have seen in the last 30 or 40 years. So I want to thank also, finally, your Chancellor Bernadette Gray Little for welcoming me here. 11 years ago, I came here to launch your lecture series. And I was honored to do it then, because I always liked Bob Dole and I always admired him. And because even when we knew we were going to be running against each other for president, we found a way to work together. And so I think we need to be serious about this topic today. We can all say, well, here we are at a university, we have comfortable lives, we'll pat each other on the back, say, isn't it nice that we're nice to each other? This is a much more serious subject. For the polarization of American politics is present not just in Washington, but in American life. You just look at how many of our collective bigotries we have overcome in America in the last 100 years. We are less racist than we used to be. We are less sexist than we used to be. We are less religiously bigoted than we used to be. We are less homophobic than we used to be. We have one remaining bigotry. We don't want to be around anybody that disagrees with us. Now we're laughing, but you know it's true. We don't even want to watch television news we disagree with. My late mother-in-law, whom I adored, Hillary's mom, lived with Hillary in Washington when she was a senator and secretary of state until she passed away at almost 92. And she was the most liberal member of our family. But she forced herself to watch an hour of Fox News every day. Now we're laughing, and I sat down with her once at the table. We're drinking a cup of coffee, watching Fox News. And I said, Dorothy, why do you do this? And she said, first, I want to know what they're saying, and I want to make sure I can answer it. And secondly, nobody's wrong all the time. And nobody's right all the time. She was a remarkable woman. But I never will forget my little lecture from my mother-in-law, who was then 90 years old. I have a couple of introductory things I want to say about this, and then I'll try to give you some examples. We live in the most interdependent age in human history. Not the most trade-dependent age. Actually, the wealthiest countries in the world were slightly more trade-dependent as a percentage of GDP before World War I than they are today. And I might caution you in considering this issue seriously that a lot of elite opinions in all the countries of the world then thought war was unthinkable between the great economic powers because they were so economically interdependent. And it turned out to be wrong. And that is because none of us are completely economic animals. And in the end, the question of how we relate to each other in America is part of the larger identity challenge that is a function of the age of interdependence, which goes beyond trade to travel and basically total immersion of instantaneous access to information of all kinds, the power of technology, the rise of the social media, the staggering capacity of the simple cell phone to do good and evil. That's what we live in. The headlines are by definition mostly negative. The trend lines, however, are not. For example, in 2000, the United Nations adopted the Millennium Development Goals, calling for big reductions in international poverty, empowerment of women, putting girls in school on an equal basis with boys, dealing with the challenges of climate change in an economically sensible way. We didn't meet all those goals, but we made a lot of progress. More than 1 billion people moved out of extreme poverty. We're moving toward parity in many places in educational opportunities for girls and boys. There's been more economic empowerment of women, and a lot of it was done by the cell phone. We all know a cell phone can be used to detonate a bomb, but when the first President Bush and I worked in South Asia after the tsunami more than a decade ago, and then I was asked to stay behind for 2 years to work for the UN, we put every family that had lost a fishing boat back in the water. And if the fishermen had been killed, then who else wanted to go got the boat and they went. But this time we gave every single one of them a cell phone. And for the first time in their lives, in Indonesia, in Southeast India, in Sri Lanka, they could find out what the price of fish was up and down the coast, and average incomes increased by 30%. We know that Boko Haram continues to terrorize northern Nigeria and the surrounding areas. But our Clinton Health Access Initiative is part of a global effort to try to save 1 million children under 5 from waterborne diseases, diarrhea, dysentery, cholera. 80% of all the people who die are under 5. For 50 cents a person, a simple oral rehydration therapy and zinc packets will save their lives. It's never in the press, but we're making our goals in Nigeria, and we are disproportionately working in those same areas. So the first thing I want you to know is that in this great age of interdependence, good things and bad things are going on. Most of the bad is rooted in a self-concept of negative identity. That is, in order for me to think well of myself, I have to think less of you to the extent that you are different from me or my religion or my ideology as I define it. To the extent that we are making progress, it is almost always the product of networks of cooperation rooted in positive identity. That is, hey, I kind of like who I am. I'm proud of my race, my faith, my gender, my whatever it is. But I think what we have in common matters more. So why don't we figure out how we can work together? Now, what's that got to do with bipartisanship at home? Everything. First of all, I could fill this vast auditorium with the surveys, the social science surveys, proving that creative cooperation among diverse groups works better than closely held decision-making by like-thinking elite. If we can miraculously here identify the person in this audience with the highest IQ and take you to the nearest really cushy room and give you whatever you wanted for the next 2 days, and the rest of us poor souls were locked in this auditorium with stale coffee, and then the same set of questions were fed in to this auditorium and to that room for 2 days, we would make better decisions than the lone genius. There's a book which illustrates this, written by a journalist named James Surowiecki, called The Wisdom of Crowds. So if you define success as the empowerment of individuals to improve their well-being and that of their families and their communities, groups make better decisions if they are diverse and they reach across the lines of experience and understanding and knowledge. Second, you live in a country with a constitution that has made us the longest continuously existing democracy in history because it mandates compromise. The founders almost bent over backwards to slow down the train of undebated thought because they were very concerned about the prospect of unlimited government power to do arbitrary things. So they gave us an executive, legislative, and judicial branch. And they gave us state and local authority with explicit responsibilities not enumerated in the Constitution. And they gave the Senate, then they required 2/3 vote to pass a treaty or to override a veto, or to escape, excuse me, a veto. And they did a lot of other things, basically, to essentially say, you guys got to work together here. Why? Because they were the founders, creatures of the enlightened. They believe there are a few final victories in politics, in economics, in social policy. They believe the most important thing was to set in motion a progress of debate and resolution, debate and resolution, debate and resolution, moving forward, so that they would be thrilled to see the things going on around the world today that involve multiple stakeholders trying to reach consensus, and mortified that the capital is often ground to a halt over ideological divides. A couple of days ago, I was in Jacksonville, Florida. And Jacksonville is a fairly large city, but it also, the city-county government is united, so it's a vast landmass. And it's the site of one of our health, my foundation's Health Matters Initiative's efforts to get people in the community to work together, get all the stakeholders together, increase health outcomes. So Jacksonville has an interesting problem. It's got the largest amount of urban green space in America, more than New York City, almost 80,000 acres. And yet it has the third highest pedestrian fatality rate in America because of the way those spaces are not connected and not necessarily related to traffic patterns, which include people walking around. So they were all gathered there to talk about how they were going to get rid of this problem and how they wanted to deal with the other lifestyle-related health challenges they face, including reasonably high rates of diabetes and other problems. The point is, everybody was there. The Republicans and the Democrats showed up. The people in healthcare and the people in business, the people in education. There was a widely diverse representative group of the ethnic and religious makeup of the county, and they'll do that. They will succeed in doing what they're trying to do, and I urge them to use it to take on some of the bigger challenges we all face. Now, I think about this a lot. In Little Rock, where I'm going to spend the night, I have a presidential library and a school of public service. And we offer only graduate programs, 1 and 2 year programs, but half of the time of the students is spent in the field, figuring out how to turn their good intentions into positive changes. They find, without exception, to succeed over the long run, they need partners. So that their identity, I hope, will be more positive. The second President Bush, President George W. Bush, and I have joined together in a Presidential Leadership Scholars Program, which includes, with the support of his father's library and the LBJ Library, and we just had our first graduation, and it's for younger people in their 30s, mostly, who are starting out in a wide variety of careers with great promise. And it is nothing if not politically diverse. But after they spent time going through this program together, and then they stood up and told us about their experiences, they felt more strongly than ever that with the right attitude, we could solve the problems of America and do the right thing in the world. One of the things that I always liked about Bob Dole is that he could fight you like no tomorrow, but he never closed the door to actually doing something that might benefit a real person. And there's a big difference. He worked with Senator Moynihan, my wife's predecessor in the Senate in New York, on Social Security. He worked with Senator George McGovern to establish the food stamp program. He supported voting rights and its extension without fail for 25 years. When I was president, and after we had opposed each other in the presidential campaign, he served as chairman of the International Commission on Missing Persons in the former Yugoslavia to find out what happened both in Kosovo and Bosnia after the terrible conflicts there. In 2000, Bob Dole and George McGovern agreed to come in and help Senator Jim McGovern from Massachusetts, no relationship, and me to pass a $300 million program in the Congress to provide a free, nutritious meal to children in poor countries, but only if they came to school to get the meal. And we made it available in the poorest countries in the world, just as we were trying to give debt relief to them in what was called the Millennium Debt Relief Initiative. That $300 million increased school enrollment, think of this, by 6 million. In the poorest countries, it only cost $50 a person a year then to give them a nutritious meal. He was interested in that. After I left the White House in the aftermath of 9/11, Bob Dole and I joined together to help fund something called the Families of Freedom Fund, in which we propose to provide higher education assistance to the children and spouses of everyone killed and disabled on 9/11, regardless of their citizenship. There were, for example, more than 200 people from the United Kingdom who were killed. There was an enormous amount of racial diversity and no small number of Muslims who were killed on 9/11. And since then, our goal was to raise $100 million. That fund has already awarded $118 million in financial aid. That's just something we did together because we thought it was the right thing to do. And it's been really, really rewarding. It's also been good for our country. A lot of you know that Senator Dole was one of the movers behind the Americans with Disabilities Act, for good reasons, working with primarily Democratic Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa. A couple of years ago, I saw him in a wheelchair on the floor of the Senate asking them to ratify the International Convention on Disabilities and explaining to reluctant members of his own party that this would not do anything bad to America because we had the highest standards for disability rights in the entire world. But it could take people like him, when he was young, deeply injured, and give them a chance to have a fuller life. He didn't win that fight, but I think eventually we will win it. And as long as I live, I'll remember Bob Dole in his wheelchair talking to the members of the Senate about the imperative of recognizing that not only human dignity, but the human potential of everyone without regard to their physical abilities. If you go on the Dole Institute's website, there's a letter that he wrote about his recuperation from the wounds he suffered in Italy, about how he's adapting to life with his disabilities. He downplayed the pain and barely mentioned that he'd already gotten himself elected to the state legislature. He got a degree and a law degree after the war, and with that, that sort of just tacked on. But here's what he said. Though rehabilitation is an endless task, I feel confident that the most difficult period has passed. I have not made any appreciable economic gain, but I have salvaged happiness and security out of bitter disappointment by rebuilding shattered dreams and reshaping aspirations. I give thanks to God for this opportunity, which was denied the many who made the supreme sacrifice. That experience kept Bob Dole in a place that enabled him to balance his enormous political skills and his great ambition with the understanding that life is fleeting, things can change, and ultimately what makes a democracy work is whether it responds to the challenges of a given moment. And that rarely happens when political paralysis takes over. This year marked the 20th anniversary of a number of events which had a lot to do with my presidency, but listen to them and think if they have any relevance to our current challenges. This was the 20th anniversary of the bombing of the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City. This was the 20th anniversary of the Donnybrook we had, which led to two government shutdowns, but also in 1996, the passage of the balanced budget bill, which gave us three surpluses in a row when I was president and left another one when I left office. It was the 20th anniversary of the ceasefire in Northern Ireland, which led to peace there. The 20th anniversary of our decision to give financial assistance to Mexico when it was on the verge of bankruptcy. And I have to say that when I hear all this stuff about immigration in Mexico, how we need a five-story wall along the Rio Grande River, I never hear anybody say there was no net in-migration of undocumented people from Mexico from 2010 to 2014. In fact, the numbers went down, and apparently, according to an article I read last week, they're going down again this year. Why? Because we helped them to build a self-sustaining economy. I'll talk a little more about that later, because Bob Dole supported me in that. The 20th anniversary of the slaughter of 8,000 men and boys in Srebrenica in Bosnia that led to NATO's military action in the end of the Bosnian War, which claimed a couple of hundred thousand lives and made 2.5 million refugees, the worst ethnic cleansing since the end of World War II. Most of the victims were European Muslims. And interestingly enough, the late Pope John Paul II called me within a few days of the King of Saudi Arabia, both of them pleading with me to do something to save their lives across the lines that divide. It's the 20th anniversary of the normalization of our relationships with Vietnam. 58,000 Americans were killed in that war. Many, many more Vietnamese. They're still working with us to find the remains of soldiers that were lost there. And they are now our strongest ally in Southeast Asia. Why am I telling you all this? Because the bipartisanship issue is just one piece of this huge coming together and the identity crises that it creates. We live in a world with a lot of instability, a world with a lot of economic inequality, a world threatened by the growth of population and the depletion of resources and the looming specter of climate change. And there is not an end of power, but a dispersal of power. So in the face of insecurity, the most predictable path, going back to the beginning of humanity and people coming out of caves and clans, is to stick to your own kind and try to just push everybody else away as much as you can. But in an interdependent world where you can't get away, where actions anywhere affect people everywhere, it's probably not the best choice. Which doesn't mean we shouldn't worry about legitimate security concerns. It just means we can't escape each other. So the real question of the 21st century is not whether Americans will live together, but on what terms. The real question of the 21st century is not whether we will live with people all around the world, but on what terms. Will our interdependence be positive or negative? Human nature being what it is, it's a little bit of both, but it is clear that for every one of the young people here, the students, for the children you hope to have, the grandchildren I hope you live to see, our job is to build up the positive and reduce the negative forces of our interdependence, to try to keep big bad things from happening and make as many good things happen as possible and make sure people understand what the promise as well as the peril is of the age in which we live. Believe it or not, if I could do it, I'd give up being president to be 20 again and take my chances, because I think there's a good chance this will be the most peaceful, prosperous time in human history, a time of breathtaking scientific advances in which all the bad things we're worried about will probably not be quite as bad as we feared, and the good things we hoped for will probably be more bountiful than we dreamed. But only if we understand that the world is full of positive and negative forces, that nobody has as much absolute power as some governments once did, and that every person, whether in government or not, just in your workplace or in your citizen space, working with or supporting a non-governmental effort, has a responsibility to maximize the possibilities and minimize the perils. And it all begins with the idea that what we have in common is more important than our interesting differences. In 1998, on a bipartisan vote, we passed an amazing budget, which included doubling the budget for the National Institutes of Health and had the last big chunk of money of the $3 billion of your tax money I spent to sequence the human genome. The best money we ever spent. You got a good return on investment. There've already been in excess of $800 billion in economic activity generated from that. San Diego, long known as the naval capital of America, is now the human genome research capital of America. There are 700 computer companies alone that have been formed there just to do aspects of this scientific research. In New York, Sloan Kettering, in California, Dana-Farber, in Texas, MD Anderson, in Memphis, St. Jude's Children's Hospital, in Los Angeles, the pathbreaking research of a Chinese South African American doctor named Patrick Soon-Shiong. They're all made possible because of the advances in the human genome. I've talked to two or three doctors who work in this field just in the last 10 days, and I asked them the same question and got a resounding yes to both when I said, do you actually believe that we might get to an 85% or higher survival rate for all forms of cancer within 10 years? All three said, absolutely. Because of what we have learned about how to get the human body to defend itself and how to attack tumors. Now, all the years that I work with Bob Dole, even when we were fighting, we only had one sort of unresolved disagreement, and that was over health care. And I couldn't blame him because, heck, he wanted to run for president. And that was okay. But no matter what else we were doing, in the end, I kept my door open. He kept his open. We never lost our sense of humor. And we found a way to try to do what seemed to be best for the American people. This Mexican peso crisis was really interesting. I was talking to you about it before, but on the day that I had to help Mexico, Bob Dole and Newt Gingrich were for me, and they wanted the Congress to vote to do it. But there was an article in the morning paper that said by 81 to 11, the American people were against my helping Mexico. But keep in mind, this was, you know, early 95. We hadn't fully recovered from the economic difficulties of the late 80s and early 90s. And everybody had these preconceptions about Mexico. But Bob Dole knew it was the right thing to do. And when they paid the money back 3 years early with almost $600 million in interest, even his own members had to say, well, you were right and we were wrong. But I want to bring it back. Something happened to him, laying in all those hospital beds, struggling to recover his movement, learning to have a discipline of gratitude because at least he had lived when so many others had died, that made it possible for him to identify with other people. So that no matter how hard you fought or how much you disagreed, you didn't want to dehumanize people to the point where when it came right down to it, you couldn't join hands with them and do what had to be done to keep going forward. That is the essence of the tests we all face today. You look at the people of all, the faces of all those young people who committed murders in Paris, and you realize that they had been swayed in a very different direction. To believe there at the very beginning of their lives there was somehow more glory in a premature death that claimed the lives of anonymous, innocent people than there was in getting up and going to work the next day and trying to learn something useful and use it to change other people's lives. So this celebration of bipartisanship, we fed a lot of people on the McGovern-Dole food program around the world. Now, there are all these poor kids that are, we started 15 years ago, so a lot of them are grown now. Their lives are different now. And they don't know who Bob Dole is, and they don't know who Bill Clinton is. But they do know that they're alive, they're healthy, they have an education. Because people who had a certain responsibility decided it would be a good thing to work together. All those people whose hearts were broken on 9/11, who lost loved ones or had them horribly disabled, but who got aid to begin again with their own lives and get a college education. Because Bob Dole and Bill Clinton, two people that are probably largely irrelevant to the young people's lives, hustled up a bunch of money from other people and said, why don't you give us something to send these kids to school? It makes a difference. And so let's come back to the genome. The genome, yes, will raise your chances of surviving any kind of cancer. And will, I hope one day, provide a cure for ALS and a lot of other totally debilitating diseases. We're already making real progress with Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. But no matter what you think you care about, as a citizen, the most important finding of the human genome has already been made. It is that every non-age-related difference you see in this audience, you think about this when you go out now, every non-age-related difference, body size and shape, skin color, eye color, hair or lack thereof, even gender, is rooted in 0.5% of your genome. Now, if you're a scientist, let's be fair, since you've got 3.6 billion genomes, 0.5% is a pretty good number. But still, it means that we're 99.5% the same. And yet, this is not just politics. Don't we all spend 99.5% of our time thinking about the 0.5% of us that's different? Really, don't we? We are in this sports frenzy period where we're coming to the end of an exciting football season and we're beginning basketball season. And, you know, I don't know how many times I'm guilty. I'm not going to point the finger at you. I have walked down the street, bypassed, let's say, a department store window or something that's got a reflection, and thinking, you know, if I had a body like LeBron James, I would have gone in a different line of work. I mean, haven't we all done it? I wish I were a little taller, a little thinner, a little this or a little that or. But it is an act of supreme arrogance to believe that our differences are more important than our common humanity. And it is a recipe for disaster in an interdependent world. Because it unleashes us to act on impulse in a dehumanizing way to other people. We live in a country with a constitution that puts limits on everybody. I got in an interesting argument once with another of my political adversaries, whom I liked very much personally, not Bob Dole, whom I like also, but this guy was not as accommodating. And the reason I got into this argument is that he said, you really believe we should all be treated the same, don't you? I said, I do. He said, we don't believe that. We believe there should be one set of rules for us and another set for you. If you believe we should all be treated the same, there are some things you just won't do, aren't there? I said, absolutely. He said, that puts you at a terrible disadvantage. Now, here's what I want to say to all of you. I don't care if you're Republican, Democrat, Independent, or whatever. We know the Constitution mandates compromise, and we know that groups make better decisions than small, homogenous elites. And we know that everywhere in the world where people are practicing inclusive politics and inclusive economics to get inclusive societies, good things are happening. And everywhere in the world, someone believes that they are in so much possession of the truth, they have the right to kill innocent and anonymous people at random, or just spend all their time fighting, good things are not happening. This is not rocket science. And the findings of the human genome, that were 99.5% the same, simply confirm the teachings of all great faiths. The New Testament, love your neighbor as yourself. The Torah, he who turns aside a stranger might as well turn aside from the Most High God. The Quran, Allah put different people on the earth, not that they might despise one another, but that they might come to know one another and learn from one another. The Dhammapada of the Buddha, you are not fully human until you can feel the arrow piercing another's skin as if it were entering your own body. So I ask you to think about that. The great struggle in America to restore some sort of balance to our politics is a reflection of the awful anxieties that many of our people feel because of the combination of economic disappointment and cultural conflicts and change. We learned, for example, just this week, two Nobel Prize-winning economists saying that life expectancy for white, non-college-educated working people in their middle years is dropping because of increased alcohol consumption, prescription drug consumption, and a variety of other destructive behaviors. But really, they're dying from a broken heart. You don't ever want to get in a position where you don't have something to look forward to when you get up in the morning. Bob Dole became Bob Dole instead of some tragic victim of World War II because he had the will and discipline to find something to look forward to when he got up in the morning. And then he saw it in other people's lives. It turned out there were some things he just wouldn't do, as a result of which he got a lot done. I like all these debates. I like a good fight as well as the next person. But in the end, the Constitution was set up so that it might have been subtitled, Let's Make a Deal. Go read it if you don't believe me. And we voters, those of us who can't run for anything, we have to remember that we sometimes feed this. We feed it if we only want to be around people we agree with, and we feed it if we don't vote in elections just as well as if we do. Nobody gets off scot-free here. But if you want public service that addresses the great challenges of the age, a serious attempt to restore broad-based prosperity, and a serious response to the security challenges we face that does not require us to abandon our basic values, but does make us a safer country, but still an inclusive one. We got to go back to that. Two final things. The most important political book I've read in 5 years was not written by a politician or a political scientist or even a historian, but by a double Nobel Prize-winning microbiologist named E.O. Wilson, who most of us know because he has warned us for decades that we are destroying species on planet Earth at the most rapid rate in 10,000 years because of the way we develop. This book is less than 250 pages long, if I remember correctly. It's called The Social Conquest of Earth. And in it, Dr. Wilson attempts, insofar as the evidence will permit, to describe the life, all life on planet Earth, going back to the emergence of single-cell organisms from the primordial slime and then the differentiation of species. And he says that any reasonable look at all history, including prehistory based on the evidence, would lead you to conclusions that of all the species that have ever existed on Earth, the four most successful are ants, termites, bees, and people. E.O. Wilson is a guy that taught me 20 years ago that the combined weight of all the ants on Earth is greater than the combined weight of all the people on Earth. That's a lot of ants. There are species in Africa, for example, that when being chased by predators, a bunch of them will just go up on the tallest sprig of grass and sacrifice themselves so that everybody else can get away. There are termites in South America, in hot and wet climates, that build underground housing with five holes, one to go in and out of, the other four are simply for air conditioning. I myself, last summer, when my daughter and I were on our foundation trip to Africa, went to this elephant preserve in northern Kenya. It's one of our partners in trying to preserve the African elephants, and I, with my own eyes, saw three different anthills that were more than 5 feet high. One was about 6 feet high, and it was built around a tree, like a hotel with its own shade tree. Bees, you know all the things they do. Wilson's point is this. He said, so there's ants, termites, and bees, and then there are people. The difference is we have two things ants, termites, and bees don't have. And we have far greater potential for good because of our consciousness and our conscience. We haven't just devolved our patterns of communication. We can think and grow quickly and feel. But, he said, because we have these, we are prone to arrogance. And therefore, we're always just dancing around the edges of our own destruction in hazardous times. But every time we come right up to the brink, we have instead done what was necessary to go forward. And he's almost 90 now. He said, I'm betting that's what we're going to do again. So I will say again, the history of bipartisanship, which the Dole Institute seeks to advance, which Senator Dole's career embodies both in office and after he left, the stuff we've done together, is an example of the triumph of cooperation over conflict. An example of diverse groups making better decisions than homogenous elites. An example of the kind of compromise that our founding fathers sought to drill into the fabric of American life. I want to read you something I wrote in my autobiography about Bob Dole. This is when we were running against each other for president in 1996. After a rocky start in February, Bob Dole won all the primaries in March, wrapping up his party's nomination with a late-month victory in California. Even though Senator Phil Graham, who ran to the right of Dole, would have been easier to beat, I was pulling for Dole. No election is a sure thing, and if I lost, I believe the country would be in more solid and moderate hands with him. That's what I thought when we were in the middle of a campaign, fighting in debates, trying to beat each other's brains out. And that's a good thing, not a bad thing. So I leave you with that. Next time you think there's no hope and there's no way for us to work out whatever the heck we're fighting about, or whatever you're arguing about here, remember the 99.5%. We need to devote a little more time to thinking about that, a little less time than 0.5%. Remember, all the scientists did was uncover what the great fates have been telling us all along. And remember, you live in the most glorious period in history in terms of its potential, and one of the scariest in terms of its potential. We are condemned to share the future. The only thing that's open for question is what the terms of the sharing will be. And that is for you to decide. Thank you very much.
That's former President Bill Clinton receiving the Dole Leadership Prize at the University of Kansas LEAD Center. We'll now join KPER News Director Jay Schaefer and State House Bureau Chief Stephen Caranda for some brief analysis.
So some of the things that really struck me in this speech, he talked a lot about his campaigning against Bob Dole, one of his political rivals, but also someone who he worked a lot with. And he said some interesting things. Specifically, he talked about Bob Dole. He said he'd fight you and he'd fight for his perspective, but he wouldn't close the door. Bob Dole was ultimately willing to compromise to achieve something. And he credited his injuries and his time recovering, realizing that life is fleeting, things can change, and that's what led him to be willing to compromise and work with others to kind of find some solutions on big issues.
He talked about diversity and the importance of bipartisanship, especially these days when there is so much gridlock in Washington.
Pretty interesting speech. I touched on some good themes, some themes of working together. I really like how he tied in Senator Dole and his work much more than I thought he would in the speech.
That's KPR's State House Bureau Chief Stephen Caranda and News Director Jay Schaefer. They were on hand at the University of Kansas LEAD Center on November 23, 2015, when former President Bill Clinton received the Dole Leadership Prize. Thanks to KPR producer Laura Lorson, engineers Jason Sloat and Steve Kincaid, and Andy House of the LEAD Center for help with today's program. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas. Did you miss last week's KPR Presents, where we talked about other presidents who have visited KU? You can find it and most previous episodes of KPR Presents on our website, kpr.ku.edu. That's kpr.ku.edu.